The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 180.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. She is one of my partners with Rebel Capitalist Pro, and she is a rock star on FinTwit. I remember when I first interviewed her, this would have been at the beginning of 2020, she maybe had 10,000 followers on Twitter, and I told her then that she was a rock star and a superstar, and sure enough, she blew up like I knew she would. She's the brightest, or one of the brightest people out there for sure. Now she has well over 100,000 followers on Twitter. Her name is Lynn Alden. Lynn, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So you just came out with a blog post, maybe a couple weeks ago, about the petrodollar. And a lot of people have heard about the petrodollar, but I don't think they understand how vital it is to the dollar being the world reserve currency. And I don't think they understand how that petrodollar system is starting to deteriorate and what that means for the dollar long term and how we should position our investment portfolio accordingly. So I want to pull up, or have the editors pull up, your actual blog post and have us kind of go through that whole thing. You can walk us through it and give us your thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so this has been a while in the making. We've talked about this on other shows and in, you know, your pro service. But basically, you know, this takes like a, you know, a 50-year view of the current global monetary system as it's been structured. Mm-hmm. And so it starts off by going into some of the prehistory, right? So everyone's, you know, most people familiar with your channel are familiar with the Bretton Woods system, which was that, you know, during the end of World War II, the United States, you know, had their currency pegged to gold, and other currencies agreed to peg themselves to the dollar. And that was because the United States was, you know, they were the dominant force after the war. They had most of the gold. They had, you know, the least harmed economy compared to many of their allies and enemies. And so they were in a position to basically be the axiom of the system. And there were some competing forces back then. So there are some people that were advocating for something like a bank war, which would have been, you know, essentially a basket of multiple currencies, like a neutral reserve asset. But then, of course, the United States' position was arguing in favor of making the dollar itself the center of the system.
Right.
And so the United States' position won out. They had the most leverage in that particular conversation. And so we had the Bretton Woods system. And so the flaw over time, so there were some economists like Robert Triffin and others that warned that this would not be a permanent system because eventually U.S. liabilities in the form of you know, treasuries and dollars overseas would eventually eclipse the amount of gold that they can support those with and make it redeemable. And that's right. Exactly what happened. So if you look over time, they had a gradual reduction in gold and we had a continual increase in the dollar liabilities abroad. And eventually in 1971, they broke that system. But you can look at a chart.
Running out of gold, and the foreigners were saying, okay, I don't want these green pieces of paper anymore. Give me my yellow metal.
Yeah, they call the bluff. They ask for the physical, and yeah. So we all look at 1971 as the key moment. But if you look on some of the data, there was several years leading up to that where it was clearly becoming unsustainable. And so ever since 1971, we've been in a floating exchange rate, totally fiat global monetary system, which is that all these currencies are just backed by nothing. They're not pegged to anything, and they're just backed by the U.S. government or in other countries, their governments, which is that, you know, only that currency is acceptable for tax payments and is used as a unit of account. And that's how they kind of enforce the usage of that currency. But this, of course, opened a big can of worms in the 1970s because all these countries had pieces of paper. So how do you do international trade? What, you know, how is that going to work, right? Because it's literally all the currencies pegged by nothing is totally worthless. And so starting in the early to mid 1970s, the United States made a deal with Saudi Arabia, which extended to the rest of OPEC, to only price their oil in dollars. So no matter who Saudi Arabia sells their oil to, whether it's United States, France, another European country, Japan, whatever the case may be, they only sell it in dollars. Which means that other countries either need to earn dollars, so many of them will then price their goods and services that they export in dollars, or they need to exchange their currency for dollars. And that makes it so that there's a global demand for dollars. Mm. And so that actually was a very clever system at the time, because they basically reordered something out of chaos, right? So it had all sorts of negative ramifications, but you can see their incentive at the time. And of course, that was during the Cold War. So the United States wanted to have as much kind of hegemonic power as possible against the Soviet Union rather than being isolationist. And so we had this system where the United States was not, you know, the dollar was not pegged to oil, but it was essentially backed by oil instead of being backed by gold. And so instead of being redeemable for nothing, it was the only currency in the world that was pretty much, you know, redeemable for oil.
Yeah. Lynn, I'm sorry to cut you off there. How big of a percentage back then was Saudi Arabia's production of oil as far as global oil production? Was it like 99% or was it like 50%?
No, it wasn't 99%. I don't have the exact number. You know, the United States was still a significant producer, but they started, you know, holding it back after that. Saudi Arabia and the rest of OPEC was a very large producer. And of course, Russia was a very large producer. So we had a similar dynamic as to now. But I don't have the exact percentages.
But with that agreement with Saudi Arabia, where they said, okay, you got to price it in dollars. I'm just trying to think through how much of global production at that point in time was specifically done in dollars. You see what I'm saying? Like if Russia was still probably selling their oil in rubles, let's say. So, you know, was it 95 or any idea on that number?
I don't know the exact percentage. I know today, you know, there may be 10%, and then you have the rest of OPEC. It was basically a chunk that they could control a large portion of the global energy market, especially when you also add the US share, which of course that, you know, any amount that they were dealing with was in dollar base as well. And so it basically had a critical mass of dollar support.
Got it. Okay.
And so from there, you know, we had a really interesting system develop because, you know, we often think of this as the U.S. having an exorbitant privilege, right? So we are the only country in the world pretty much that could, you know, print money to buy commodities, essentially, that our, you know, quote unquote, worthless pieces of paper could be converted to real goods. And by extension of the system, because of the way network effects work, most other commodities were priced, you know, mostly in dollars. And we started to see a lot of global financing happening in dollars, meaning that, you know, if a company or a government in an emerging market needed to raise money, you know, a lot of investors are, of course, wary about raising money and you know, lending money and getting paid back in the local currency. So they would do it in dollars often. So we started to develop the infamous, you know, offshore dollar denominated debts. Of course, we already had that before then, but it began, you know, kind of rapidly accelerating as the dollar further entrenches network status. Mm-hmm. And so over several decades, a problem that we've seen is that in order to run the system, the United States pretty much has to run persistent trade deficits because there's only a handful of ways that they can get dollars out there. So if you enforce a mechanism where every country in the world needs dollars in order to buy oil and other commodities, then there has to be enough dollars out there, right? It has to be a global currency. And so we're in the situation where, you know, at the beginning of the system, the United States was something like 35% of global GDP. But over time, we've gone down to something like 20% of global GDP and a little bit higher, a little bit lower, depending on exactly what metric you use to measure it.
Right.
And so that's been an issue because, you know, something like, you know, close to 60% of reserves are held in U.S. dollars and a very big percentage of global trade is in dollars, even though we're only about a fifth of global GDP.
Yeah. And you know, so I'm sorry, yeah. Lynn, I'm looking at your report right now. And you've got a chart here that's from the BIS, or maybe the International Monetary Fund, and it's going over the percentage of global payments in specific currencies, international loans, and foreign exchange reserves. And you see exactly kind of how dominant the dollar is right now. But then the chart right below that is showing our trade deficit, which is just staggering. Where it is now, where it was at the early 2000s, but then comparing that to where it was when this petrodollar system actually began. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and it's brought us down to, we used to be one of the world's largest creditor nations. In fact, we used to be the single, you know, biggest creditor nation in the world, which means that we owned more foreign assets than foreigners own of our assets.
Right.
But then over time, because you've been running persistent trade deficits, over time, now we're a net creditor, debtor nation, meaning that, you know, foreigners own more U.S. assets than Americans own of foreign assets. And so it's created a very interesting dynamic because, you know, we basically outsource. So in the Bretton Woods system, we basically chipped away at our gold stash to maintain the system. We kept kind of, you know, dismantling our gold reserves over time and reassembling that overseas. We kind of did that with our manufacturing base in this system. And so instead of our dwindling gold reserves, we have a dwindling manufacturing base. And what's important to realize is that, Northern Europe and Japan, they didn't have that problem. So it wasn't like all developed countries had their industrial base brought down and kind of put in emerging markets. That, of course, happened to an extent, especially for cheap products. But the United States drew down its industrial base at a far faster rate than most other developed countries because we were the axiom of the system. And that's how this system was structured.
Yeah. So, Lynn, can you kind of walk us through just from A to Z how that process works? Because I know a lot of people hear that, well, we just outsourced our manufacturing or we sent all of those jobs overseas. But what's the rationale there? If you're XYZ Corporation in the United States, what's going through your head? Are you just producing goods overseas because it's a lot cheaper and we can continue to do that without having any downside because the dollar, there's so much artificial demand from it being the global currency in this petrodollar system? Or is there something else though that I'm missing?
There are a few factors, but the main one is related to currency differentials. And so because the entire world needs dollars, there's a lot of persistent demand for dollars. And so if you look at most countries, if they start to run persistent trade deficits for a while, then the next time they have a recession or some sort of financial event, usually what happens is their currency ends up getting pretty weakened, right? There's kind of a, you know, the international market realizes there's a problem there, and you end up having, you know, so much outflows that you have a currency weakening event. And what that does is, you know, it's painful when it happens, but when it happens, it makes their export competitiveness stronger and it reduces their import capability. And so it ends up realigning their trade deficit back towards a more balanced state. But the United States, we never go through that process. When we have recessions, often our dollar gets stronger. And so we never are in a position where our currency kind of makes sense relative to our balance of trade. We don't have that corrective mechanism that most other countries have. And that's kind of that's the core issue. Then there are some other factors like, fiscal policy and kind of geopolitical policy. And so a lot of these other countries have rather mercantilist policies where they try to purposely maximize exports, and keep their import power, somewhat tight. So a lot of them were purposely weaken their currencies as much as possible compared to the U.S. dollar. And for example, Switzerland will just print a lot of their currency and then buy, you know, American assets, for example.
Apple.
Exactly. Even Apple stock. Yeah. So it started, of course, with treasuries, right? You print money, you buy treasuries, you build up your foreign exchange reserves. But they've also moved into even just outright buying U.S. equities. And so what that does, Switzerland's like they probably do that more egregiously than any other country, but there are a bunch of countries that do that. And whereas the U.S., we purposely never really built foreign exchange reserves. We don't go through these processes of purposely weakening our currency unless, you know, there are a handful of times we got really bad, like in the Plaza Accord, 1985. We generally don't engage in that kind of currency weakening. We also have other things like, for example, the United States has the most expensive healthcare per capita in the world. And that, of course, is often that burden is often supported by employers. Right. So, it's much more expensive to hire someone when healthcare is twice as expensive if you're obligated to, basically pay for that employee's healthcare compared to if you were operating in another country. And right. So there are a variety of factors related to tariffs, related to monetary policy, all sorts of reasons. And it revolves around the fact that the United States has to get dollars out into the system if those dollars are going to be able to be purchasable for commodities for countries around the world.
Yeah. And an environment domestically that allows us or incentivizes us to get that manufacturing overseas. So it's not just about price, it's about what you're saying. But I also want to focus or just mention that it's a lot to do with regulations as well. When I mean, you touched on it there with the healthcare, but if the government imposes heavier and stricter regulations, it doesn't make a lot of sense for someone to take that $1 billion out of their back pocket and take 10 years to build a manufacturing plant in, let's say, California, when you have no idea what the political environment is going to be. You have no idea what the taxes are going to be, the regulatory environment. It's just, it's not a good risk reward. So I think that's one thing that people overlook. And from a macro standpoint, we don't really focus on, but as a former entrepreneur, I know that that's extremely, extremely important. Local and domestic regulations.
Yeah, so the net result over time was we had a financialization of our economy. And so we stopped making real things. We started financializing things. So we're providing financial services, becoming the financial hub of the world more and more. We also had, of course, had a very big healthcare industry, big military industrial complex. And then, one of the benefits of it, we did have a pretty strong technical sector, which most people know. A lot of that was centered around software, right? Because that doesn't really rely on making things, as well as engineering designs that we would then, have people make that in other countries. And so basically anything that's really high margin we're able to do, but anything that involves physically making things is where we're increasingly weak at. And so this lasted for several decades. It's, there's trade-offs there. And so we've seen some areas, for example, like the Rust Belt, the Midwest,
right.
That's really suffered because that's where a lot of our manufacturing base was. Whereas you've seen, for example, the coasts flourish because that's where a lot of the financialization is or the software or the healthcare. And so we basically hollowed out the center of our country, hollowed out kind of the blue collar sort of work and really doubled down on the coasts, on the white collar work and things like that.
So what does that do to wages over the long?
Well, that, yeah, definitely. It deeply suppresses wages because in addition to hiring fewer, domestic manufacturing workers, the ones that remain have a lot more foreign competition because, they're always at risk of having their plant outsourced to Mexico or China, wherever the case may be. And so that puts a lot of downward pressure on wages, especially for, again, people that work in skilled manufacturing. Or routine tasks, or even rather technical, because for example, if you look at some of the high-end manufacturing areas like Japan or Germany, right, a lot of that is advanced technicians, and the United States is even outsourcing a lot of those types of people just because we're not making the physical goods here nearly to the extent that we used to, or compared to many of our kind of advanced industrial peers.
Yeah, and it seems to me what has happened is we've turned into an economy that really revolves around financialization, to your point, but also just domestic services.
Like exactly.
you go around the block and look at what all the businesses are. And I did a video the other day. We talked about Uber, we talked about DoorDash or Topgolf or restaurants, bars, cafes, accountants, lawyers. It's like 90% of the businesses you see revolve around just selling domestic services to one another. And if you really think about it, you're like, okay, well, where's all the stuff coming from?
mostly China.
Here. Yeah. And then one more thing I'd like you to touch on. It's fascinating. I was actually listening to a Jordan Peterson video the other day, believe it or not, one of his classroom lectures. And he started talking a little bit about macro. And you can tell that he's read some books on it. I know he's not an expert, but you can definitely tell he's read some books. And he started talking about the demographic shift or more women coming into the workforce during this exact same period in the 1970s and how you basically doubled the competition for jobs. And that might have had an impact on suppressing real wages as well. Do you think that was a factor, or do you think it was really more about the petrodollar system and outsourcing these jobs to foreign countries?
I think it's one of those things where there's always multiple variables. One thing is, if you look at most other developed countries, they had a similar demographic shift, right? Yeah. Because, you know, we had more women coming into the workforce. But for example, those countries almost exclusively have less wealth concentration than the United States. So their overall, you know, middle class generally has a better standard of living in some ways compared to U.S. middle class, even though our, say, top 10% are far, far wealthier than their top 10% on average. And so a lot of this was based on specific policies that the United States did. Right. Although, of course, there's always multiple factors involved, and there is more competition for jobs now, both internationally. And it's actually, if you look at, it's interesting, if you look at Japan, Japan has been slower than most other countries to bring women into the workforce. But that's actually, they've increasingly turned towards that because of, most people know they have a shrinking population now. So they have some of the most aged and slowest growing demographics in the world. And one way that they, handled that over the past decade or so is that they've seen a sharp rise in women in the workforce. And it's right. actually kind of crazy because even though their country's 10 years older on average, like their median age is 10 years older than the United States, in 2020, they actually have a higher labor participation rate than the United States. Because
overall,
we had
women.
Overall, age 15 and over. Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Now, is that because Japan, I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent here, but is that because Japan is really propping up a lot of these zombie companies? Because I talked to Snyder about that, and he's like, Japan is already doing MMT, and they basically already have a jobs guarantee program.
Well, I think part of it also is that they don't have that trade imbalance, right? So their trade balance is pretty much settled. And so they have a healthier blend of making things as well as some of the more financial services. And as far as MMT goes, for example, they have been running smaller, sovereign deficits as a percentage of GDP than the United States has. And so we all know of Japan as like their central bank balance sheet going vertical, but the actual growth of the money supply and the sovereign deficits as a percentage of GDP have been lower than the United States. So they actually have far slower M2 growth over the past 10 and 20 years. And so I would somewhat not quite call that MMT. In the same way, it's of course there's a lot of similarity. There's a lot of financialization. It's a little bit different than the idea of, for example, running a three trillion dollar stimulus and just injecting that into the economy. They haven't really been doing that to the same degree that we have.
Yeah. Okay. So we understand the system. We understand some of the negative unintended consequences. But now you're saying that this petrodollar system is starting to deteriorate. So I'm specifically at your subtitle in the post where you're talking about the fraying of the petrodollar system. So kind of take us through what you see playing out in the future.
Yeah, so there are a couple big forces happening. One is that, even within the system, we generally have these big like 15-year dollar cycles. And so every 15 years ago or so, we tend to have a big shift in fiscal monetary policy. We start to get a much stronger dollar. And then usually what happens is foreigners buy fewer treasuries. We end up having to finance more of our deficits. And we end up, trade slows. The dollar becomes very strong. It makes our exports even less competitive. And we generally get, kind of a flat line in corporate profits. And we usually then see a shift. We see, more dovish monetary policy or recession, whatever the case may be. And that, you know, as that kind of resolves, we generally see a weaker dollar. And so we've had really three really big dollar cycles within this past, you know, 50-year monetary system. And of course, just because you have a bear market in the dollar does not mean that the dollar is losing global reserve status, right? So I think, you know, one thing I try to point out in that post is a dollar bear market is not the same thing as losing dollar reserve status. So we've had three major bear markets in the dollar without losing any degree of that status. So a couple of structural shifts are happening currently that are different from what happened in those cycles. And so one is that we don't have as much foreign demand for treasuries as we used to. And there's a couple. It's largely centered on China, but there's a couple of reasons for it. And so in the early stages of this, Europe was one of our biggest trading partners. So we would run persistent trade deficits with Europe. They would get all these dollars and they would reinvest those dollars into treasuries and hold them as, you know, foreign exchange reserves. And then, Japan, we had the big, rise of Japan in the 70s and the 80s. And so they started to run really big trade deficits with us. They would get all these dollars and they would invest those dollars into treasuries and hold them as their foreign exchange reserves. And so that's why, even though the U.S. is running persistent trade deficits, we're still benefiting in some ways because foreigners are financing our deficits more so than most other developed countries.
Right. Keeping the interest rates low. That's key, because going back to what you're saying, although real wages have really plateaued, we haven't had too much of a squeeze because we've been able to, asset prices have gone up and the cost of buying a home has gone down, even though prices go up because the mortgage payment goes down, because interest rates go down. And then so debt in our system becomes a lot cheaper as a result of this foreign demand for treasuries.
Yeah, and it's also, it's not just interest rate, because, for example, if you look at Japan, they've had lower interest rates than us. A lot of it has to do with the quantity of capital. So, for example, if you don't have foreign demand, you're not doing QE, then if the federal government were to run deficits, that means that someone else in the domestic economy is buying those treasuries. So they're, we're sucking capital out of one part of the system and injecting it into another part of the system. But if foreigners are buying our treasuries, then we're not sucking dollars out of anywhere in the domestic economy. At least on net, and instead we're getting this kind of, our trade deficits being recycled back into our deficits.
Right, and those domestic dollars can be reinvested, where if it was just all domestic demand for treasuries, then they wouldn't be able to be reinvested by the producers who are earning them in the first place. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, so we've been able to run bigger deficits. We've been able to, get away with looser fiscal policy. So then in the past 20 years, we've seen the rise of China. And, for the first 15 years or so, they were on the same course where they would run persistent trade deficits with us, take all those dollars and reinvest them and hold a ton of treasuries. They accumulated well over $1 trillion worth of treasuries. But then in 2013, they said it's really no longer in our best interest to keep buying treasuries. And instead, they launched the Belt and Road Initiative. So they were still running these big dollar surpluses. It kind of flatlined over time, but they were still having a strongly dollar positive position. But instead of buying more treasuries, they actually slowly reduced their treasuries. And instead they invested in dollar-based loans around the world, developing countries in Africa, Eastern Europe, the rest of Asia, Latin America. And a lot of them were commodity related.
Yeah,
and, right. And it's, because China, of course, is a very large commodity importer, including oil. And so, part of this was infrastructure and commodities centered around, basically exporting Chinese know-how, right? Because they're pretty good at infrastructure. So the combination of financing and technical, infrastructure development, and then in return, they get all this, these trade partnerships, they get these, commodity rights, things like that. And so we've been in a situation where foreigners are not really buying our treasuries to the extent that they used to.
Right. And that doesn't even include all the private Chinese investment. I remember, I think I tweeted something about your article, and I think I tweeted one of your charts that shows all of the loans that have been made, the dollar denominated loans by the Chinese. And someone said, well, yeah, but there's nothing in Vancouver, Canada. I said, yeah, these are just dollar loans. These aren't private investments. If it had the private investments on there, it would be even more sobering than it is just looking at the dollar denominated loans they've extended.
Yep. Yeah. And yeah, the ones in Vancouver, because they're not loans, they're buying assets, they're buying, properties. And so, yeah, that chart only shows a subset, as you mentioned. And So that's the one structural thing we've been seeing, is that we're not seeing this kind of newfound source of demand for treasuries like we did after Europe with Japan and after Japan with China. There's really kind of no one left here. A second thing we're seeing is that because the United States has decreased as a percentage of global GDP over time, mainly because of the rise of China and other emerging markets, there's just not a lot of dollars in the system. And I know you've had Jeff Snyder on a number of times, and we're always talking about this dollar shortage, right?
Yeah, so what I are just some talked of the- to Brent too.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like, what are the reasons for this dollar shortage? And a lot of it has to do with how much dollar dominant debts there are, how the euro dollar system structure. There's all, you know, we all have different expertise. We focus on different areas. A lot of it also has to do with the shale oil boom in the U.S. Because that somewhat controlled our trade deficits over the past decade. And so we've had kind of a flatlining trade deficit.
In other words, it reduced them because we were exporting so much oil. Is that correct?
More like we exported some, but we also were able to import less than we would otherwise have had to.
Okay.
And so that's persisted. So the combination of the U.S. is shrinking as a percentage of global GDP. We became a little bit more energy self-sufficient, and that's not really good for the offshore dollar market. And in addition, now that we've seen the rise of China as kind of an economic competitor, you know, they're actually importing more commodities than we are. And yet they're still generally doing it in dollars. And so that's not a very advantageous position for them. And so we've seen, for example, Russia has been very persistent in wanting to price their oil in euros rather than dollars. Mm-hmm. And over the past two or three years, they've been very successful in that. They de-dollarized their foreign exchange reserves, right? So they sold most of their treasuries. They started putting most of it into gold. And they've been selling their oil and gas to Europe and China largely in euros. And so we've seen a rapid rise in euro pricing and a decrease in dollar pricing for their energy. Russia's also been successful in doing that with India. And so if you just look at, you know, Russia with Europe, Russia with China, Russia with India, we're seeing de-dollarization. And so all these kind of energy importers are, you know, we're starting to see around the edges that the petrodollar system no longer has that complete lock on the global energy market that it once had.
Yeah, I'm looking at a chart that's basically outlining what you're talking about from your report. And just to be clear, when you're talking about China as an example, paying for Russian exports in euros instead of dollars, just to give people some context, and editor, you can throw this up, but 6 years ago, 98% of the transactions were done in dollars. And as of 2020, only 33% are done in dollars between China and Russia. Just wanted to throw that in there so people understand the magnitude of what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's been a very large shift. And of course now, that was really before that the Chinese digital currency was launched. And so we're gonna have to see over the next couple of years if that might further accelerate it. In addition on that chart, even though the euro has kind of become kind of a regional currency for energy pricing among those countries, we're also seeing increased trade with their local currency, so increased rubles and yuan. Right. And so it'll be interesting to see if China can increase the usage of their digital currency with some of their trading partners.
Yeah. How do you see that working out? I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, but how would this Belt and Road initiative and what we're seeing with kind of the decentralization from the petrodollar system, how would that play into China advancing the digital yuan as potentially the next global currency? And I'm not saying that's happening tomorrow or next year, but maybe 5 years, you know, 10 years, maybe decades into the future. How does it all play into that network effect to where people in Africa, South America, Eastern Europe, India would start choosing to use the digital yuan instead of the dollar or whatever other alternative there is?
So I think it'll mostly be restricted to international trade, but there are, of course, a couple different areas where they could use it. One thing I've been emphasizing is a lot of people ask, if the dollar were to, you know, over time lose its global reserve currency status, what would replace it, right? Would it be the euro? Would it be the yuan? And my answer has always been no. There's no country large enough to be the axiom of the system, like right. The U.S. was in a post-World War II environment. So there's no country that's, you know, 35 to 45% of global GDP. And so the United States isn't big enough to do it anymore. China's not big enough. Europe's not big enough. And so my base case is that we're going to see more and more decentralization. So, you know, it makes sense, for example, Russia to sell oil in the currencies of their peers rather than sell them in dollars to places that, you know, that are based in euros or yuan. And so, you know, we'll see Eurasia generally de-dollarize to some extent. You know, Latin America is, you know, somewhat more in the dollar sphere. So it kind of depends on, you know, regional sources of power. But overall, with China being the biggest importer of energy, that gives them a lot of influence over some of their energy partners and some of their commodity partners, for example. So they can, for example, try to have their yuan increasingly used for some of their imports. And of course, those countries, you know, they like some of China's exports. They like some of their technology. They like some of their manufactured goods. That basically, there's even if they might not want to hold those as reserves, they know that they can cycle those back into buying goods and services from China. And so my base case over time is that we'll see a little bit more usage of Chinese currency, you know, with specifically with some of their commodity, you know, import agreements. And so it's not that really China wants to displace the dollar, it's that they want to de-dollarize their import costs.
Yeah, got it. Okay, so the bottom line, I think the takeaway there for the viewer is you see dollars being used in the global monetary system less and less over time. It's not something that happens
As a percentage, yeah.
Just as a percentage, okay. So let's go back for a moment to another subtitle in your post called Eating Your Own Cooking. And I know we touched on this briefly because you were talking about how the foreigners aren't buying as many treasuries as they used to. And I think a lot of people are probably asking in their or asking themselves, well, who's buying them? And I'm looking at this chart showing how many treasuries are going onto the Fed's balance sheet in 2020. And of course, it's going parabolic. So I think that's what you're getting at when you're talking about eating your own cooking. But can you describe that for us?
So we had a pretty kind of interesting crossover point here in 2020, which is that the Fed now owns more treasuries than the entire foreign official sector. Wow. So all central banks in the world own fewer treasuries than the Fed does. And that's never been the case in modern history. Now, there's still foreign sector still owns more treasuries total than the Fed, if you include official and private sources. Right. But we've kind of crossed over the point where the biggest the Fed holds more treasuries than all the other central banks combined, and that's because we've not seen a lot of appetite from those countries. So even though Europe's running persistent trade surpluses, even though Japan's they have a pretty balanced trade situation, China still has dollar surpluses. They're not really just cycling that back more and more into treasuries. Now we still see some interest around the margins. For example, Japan. They tend to pay attention to FX hedged treasury yields compared to their local ones. And so you do see some buying around the margins. It's not like they're all rapidly dumping their treasuries, right. But they're really just not keeping pace with the amount of treasuries that are being supplied.
Okay, so now I want to go back just momentarily, because I've noticed a couple more charts here about the concentration of wealth in the United States. And then how this petrodollar system is affecting the average Joe in the middle class. Because whether I'm on Twitter or the comments in my YouTube channel, you just hear, or in the media, you just hear it over and over and over again that the United States is the richest country on earth. We should be able to afford to do XYZ because we are the richest country on earth. And when you look at that on an individual level, that's not even close to accurate. And I'm looking at a couple of these graphs or these data sets that you have showing not only the United States investment position as a percentage of GDP compared to other countries being negative 52%, but then also the average or the median wealth for the average American is $61,000 roughly, at where, I mean, every other developed country is has a higher median wealth other than, looks like, Germany. So can you explain that to us? And once we get done with that, then I want to go over what this means for our portfolios and how we can position ourselves from an investment standpoint to take advantage of this dollar kind of system maybe gradually deteriorating over time.
Yeah, so there are a variety of reasons for it. Part of it has to do with, you know, the aforementioned problem of our blue-collar labor force being squeezed a little bit harder than many of our peers, as well as, you know, things like the fact that we have the most expensive healthcare in the world, you know, some of our tax policies, fiscal policies. The United States has a much more concentrated wealth than most other developed countries. Pretty much the only countries that are more concentrated than us, we have to go into emerging markets to find examples of that, like Russia or Brazil and things like that. And so if you look at average wealth per capita, the United States is above most other countries. And so only, you know, a handful of them, like Switzerland, are as high as us. So we actually do have a ton of wealth per capita. However, that's an average. And a lot of that is concentrated in the top, you know, 1% or 5%.
Yeah, because of Jeff Bezos and Elon
exactly.
Musk.
Exactly. And so if you then look at the median, and for people that don't know the difference, the median is represents the middle 50th percent person. So the actual typical person. The United States has a lower median wealth per capita than most other developed countries. And that's just because we're more top heavy. And that's because, you know, we've hollowed out our blue collar base more so, and we've done certain fiscal policies that we've really concentrated wealth more than many of our peers.
Yeah, I wonder why Germany is so low.
There's a couple of reasons for that. One is, you know, they had the integration of West and East Germany, and East Germany went into that. You know, that was only about three decades ago, and East Germany was very impoverished. They also have a significant renting culture. But, you know, if you were to normalize that, Germans get a lot of, you know, pension benefits and things like that that aren't really on their balance sheet.
Right.
So that's the one on that chart that's kind of an outlier that doesn't fully reflect their status quite as well as the others.
Yeah. And I think the main takeaway here is this chart that you use that I used in my video several times. And that's a year of wages no longer covers a year of family expenses. I mean, that really just sums everything up. And it's this chart of median male income going back to 1985. And they're doing that just to show kind of a one income family and taking that to a little, you know, almost, I don't know if that's 2018 or where the chart ends, but it just shows the major costs that a family of four has: college, vehicle, healthcare, housing. And how that has gone up so dramatically that now it actually exceeds the median income of a one household family, let's call it, where back in 1985, there was a big gap between the two, meaning a lot more disposable income, period. There's a lot of disposable income, where now there's basically none.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's kind of fueled some demographic shifts because you know, either a person needs to have a notably above average income to comfortably support a household, or you need to have a two income household. Right. And so, you know, as before, that was an option. And now it's like you said, you either need above average or both.
Yeah. Or going to debt.
Yeah.
And that's not a good option. Okay, Lynn. Well, this has really just blown my mind. I think when I read through this, just every single paragraph and every single chart, it was just kind of making my jaw drop. So I would encourage everyone to go to your website, check out this blog post and all the other blog posts you have, because they're just jam-packed with value and just knowledge bombs right and left. So what's your URL? Let's start with that.
LynnAlden.com, and this should be on the homepage. This one is LynnAlden.com/fraying-petrodollar-system. You can find it right on the homepage.
And now what we're going to do is a kind of a part two for this video. We're going to start discussing how people can set up their portfolio to take advantage of exactly what you're saying, and maybe the dollar over time gradually losing its reserve currency status. So we're going to record that right now for everyone, and we're going to put a link in the description below so you can check it out free of charge.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.